The Open Source Creative Podcast, Episode 59, Authentic Stupidity. Yes, this is the AI episode.
Oh, we're going to toast marshmallows, are we?
Could be.
This is the Open Source Creative Podcast, the podcast where I ramble on about creativity, process, and open source software. I'm Jason Van Gumster, your host and driver on the road to creative freedom. And as the intro showed, yeah, this is the long-awaited, distantly teased episode of the show where I get to talk about AI, machine learning, LLMs, whichever variation of acronym you want to use, not acronym, abbreviation you want to use. That's what I'm talking about. And I'm pretty nervous, I'm going to say. I don't know of any sort of post or video or audio or anything on the web that mentions this technology that doesn't get set on fire somehow. And I'm not super interested in that. I would like to have some rational discourse. It's a weird thought, you know, it's a weird place to be with it. And so I've actually taken notes. And so if for anybody who watches this on video and you see me look down, it's because that's where my notes are. And I'm checking them because, again, I have thoughts and they're still forming and they're continuing to form and they're going to form. And I may change them when I see something different based on evidence, scientific method, that sort of thing. So I'm not necessarily locked in on any particular thought or idea, but I wanted to be able to have my, there's a lot of shit to cover here. And I want to make sure that I do as much justice to the topic as possible and not going, because I'm not personally to any extreme on it. And we'll get to that in a second. And I want to have rational discourse. I want to have rational conversations about this, and I want to set the tone for that, which is why I have these notes. And that's really me setting the stage here. And so let me overall set the stage. This is the lens through which I'm operating this whole thing. Machine learning tools are not something that I knowingly use, I seek out to use as part of my life, not in my work, not for recreation, not for personal development. It is very rare, if ever, that I knowingly use these tools for anything, especially for anything productive. I just don't. Then there's a whole reason for me doing that, and I'm going to get into that more. The core of that reason, I'll say here, is that part of it doesn't interest me. The things that most people are using LLMs for, that are using these AI tools for, that most people think about when they talk about these tools, those are things I actually enjoy doing. And I'm not going to give that away. And for a lot of those things, not all of them, but for a lot of those things, I do it better. So why would I give it away? But that's why my baseline is that I am neither intimidated nor excited really about the technology. I'm curious about it, but it doesn't scare me. And while I've seen some impressive things about it, I'm not overly enamored with the technology in and of itself. It's been around for a long time, and I'm going to get to that as well. The I will say though that I have used these tools. I'm by nature curious. And of course, that goes to show also that I use them unintentionally all the time. If you're on social media, you're using, there's There's AI tools in the back end everywhere. If you're using social media, if you're doing web searches, it's unless you're using a very specific part of DuckDuckGo, your most web searches are going to be using machine learning, large language models for even part of searches. It's pervasive on the unintentional level. And then on the intentional level, again, because I like technology, I'm curious about technology, I like to learn about technology, and I want to know its limitations. I want to know what it can do and what it can't do so that I can think about it and talk about it intelligently. There's nothing worse than having opinions on a thing that you've never used or don't know or researched. So I've done a fair amount of I have a very, I know I couldn't write my own LLM, obviously. Not today, but I know how the technology works. I know how it's not just limited to large language models. I know that there's a lot, like there's a lot of nuance and other things that go in with that. And I know how the technology does, how it operates between not just the functional part of what it generates, but also how do you train it and how do you set those things up? I'm fairly well versed in that. And I've been able to experience using it in a couple different things just to test it out and try it out and see what works and what doesn't work. And then there's also parts that are still AI, but not large language models necessarily. And again, I'm going to get into that in a second. So that's my lens. That's the base that I'm starting with, is I don't really use the tools, not for code, not for art, not for having a digital friend. I don't. Maybe my life is worse off from it by some folks' measure, but I don't. But that doesn't make me anti-AI, but I'm not also pro-AI. The technology exists. I'm aware it exists. I know how it works. And for most of what I do that isn't exploring the technology itself, I'm not really currently using what most people refer to in terms of AI. Again, I'm going to get into that in a second, because there are complications with the discourse and conversation around machine learning and AI. Ironically, there is simultaneously no nuance while also trying to split hairs on what's good and bad about it, right? So people, what do I mean by that? So the no nuance part is and I'll say everybody is guilty of this. On any side of the argument, everybody's guilty of it. You've got people who are very, very adamantly pro-AI saying, you've been using AI all along and you can't get away from it. Surprise! But they're including things like the content-aware fill on digital tools like Photoshop and actually even in GIMP. They're including photogrammetry. They're including anything that's been touched with a neural network or a generational algorithm to do iterative improvement. Every one of those things kind of gets classified now as AI because, well, you want to look good to people who are throwing money at you, and AI has been the giant buzzword du jour for the last couple of years. And so everybody on one hand, everybody is claiming that everything that they can is AI. At the same time, you have people who are saying, well, generative AI is the problem, but these other types of AI are okay. And on the face of it, that sounds like that makes sense. That sounds like that is something that plays well and is a completely rational way of thinking about it. And I apologize if my dogs, you can hear them barking in the background. That's what happens. That's just what happens. So people are trying to say these other types of AI are okay. They're trying to be nuanced and say that these other types of AI are some AIs are okay, but other AIs are bullshit and a problem, particularly like generative AI. The problem is that when someone talks about generative AI, they don't know that they are also including the ones that they think they're okay. There's no the tools that do things like large data analysis for protein folding and digging into large data sets for finding medical cures and these sorts of things. That is actually the same technology. That is those are that's working with big data, right? That was a buzzword 5 years ago. Big data, right? The whole concept of working with big data and doing those sort of things, that large language models are a natural extension of that. Generative, what we think of as generative AI, whether it's generating text, music, video, images, whatever, it's a natural extension of these large language models and big data. So but you're wrong if you say generative AI bad, and these AIs that are also basically LLM technology are good. One's a natural extension of the other. You can't easily have, like, if you have one, you're going to get the other one. And therefore, any of the benefits, you're going to miss out on. And so that, like I said, that simultaneously, it's weird because you have people who are saying everything's AI because they want investment money, and that's not helping the conversation. And then the people who are saying, yeah, but not this AI or this AI, and they're trying to do the job of having that nuance and differentiating, but you're splitting hairs in the wrong places. And that's, well, I mean, not all AI is a sign. What's the way I want to say it? Not all AI is the same, but most people draw the division in the wrong places. And so rational, reasoned debate, which is what I want to have as part of this. I'd like to start this. I don't have a huge listenership on this podcast, but if I can get some small amount of good by starting a bit of rational discourse, a bit of reasoning and sanity, I think that's going to benefit everybody, because right now the people who are super pro AI are way off base talking about, you know, whatever, you know, we're going to replace everything and everything, and it's going to make life better for everyone, versus it's the next, you know, everyone else, the other side of it is you're ruining the world and it's the next coming apocalypse. Like, it's hard to hold those positions and also have rational discourse. And I don't know how to fix that. So the best I can do is try to speak rationally and hope that there are a handful of other people out there, maybe you listen to this or are starting to listen to this, who are also willing to not be at the far extremes of the next big greatest thing versus the worst possible outcome in the world. I'm not convinced that either of those things are true. And what's really been particularly disappointing, painful, has been watching the creative community eat itself. It has been one of the most disheartening experiences of the last, I'll say, 6 months. You see this a lot more in the writing communities. You're going to see it in the other ones. We've already seen it in music. We're seeing it in writing. We're going to see it more with images. We're going to see it in video. We're going to see it in a bunch of other different creative media. And what I'm talking about are AI witch hunts. The notion of somebody using a AI tool as part of their workflow and then getting called out on it by the rest of the community, or not part of the community, just people who have strong opinions and feel like voicing them, that's not helping. That's not helping anything. That's not helping. If you're interested in the downfall of AI, if you're interested in making AI not a thing, sorry to tell you, that's not helping. It's just making people paranoid and making them work harder to hide whatever they're doing. And if you're in favor of these AI tools, witch hunts, you know, you might be sitting back thinking, oh, let it burn, you know, and watching the community eat itself. You're not being helped by the situation either. These kinds of fires, mental fires, intellectual fires, meme fires, they're hard to put out and they get uncontrolled and everything burns and it's not going to be pretty. So I really, really would like the creative community to stop eating yourself. That's the only way that I can say it. Or punching yourself in the face. I don't know what the best metaphor is for it, but the whole thing of, I think this person used an AI tool and therefore they're reprehensible and their work is reprehensible and everything that they touch is reprehensible. That's not helpful. That, especially when it's a false positive, because as much as you might say, I know how to tell the difference between something that's authentic and AI generated, the fact of the matter is you don't. Sometimes it's really easy to tell, right? Sometimes it may have just been that this person sucked at drawing hands. I happen to suck at drawing hands, for what it's worth. I keep working on it, but there were examples of people who were putting up a Monet and saying, there's a photograph, an image of a Monet painting, saying that they had used AI to generate it. And the amount of people who shit talk that painting, pointing out all of the reasons why they could tell that it was AI, they were dead wrong, because it was an actual image of a Monet painting. We have these cognitive biases that we reaffirm for ourselves. We confirm what we want to believe. So we have to make it a point to imbue ourselves with some level of disbelief of our own bullshit, because that's the only way we're going to be able to move forward with that. I do want to touch on one other thing that's been complicating. Well, two little bits of news. This is happening, I guess, just this week as I record this, which is the 11th of August. And one, there was a full feature AI movie that was generated as sort of a demo by Higgsfield. And they recently publicized that they were, and the reason why this is relevant to this podcast is they recently publicized that they were open sourcing their production, which from their perspective meant that they were sharing their prompts, they're sharing their assets, sharing their whole workflow. And if you go to the website for it, it's actually really in depth in terms of what exactly they're sharing and all the bits and pieces and all the information. It's very, very comprehensive in terms of the amount of information that they shared. And the actual output, I mean, I've seen better, I've seen worse. It's, you know, that's what it is. What I'm actually most interested in, if anybody from Higgsfield happens to be watching this, which I doubt it, but, you know, one can think, open source has a very particular meaning. if you want to say that this data is open source data, if that the prompts and everything to generate the film are open source, release them under a license that means that. So make specifically put on there, because it's not on there right now. Specifically, please put on there that it's Creative Commons, and you can say Creative Commons, no attribution or no derivatives, which would be funny as hell. or, you know, non-commercial or whatever. Because again, I'd be curious about how that works, come to think of it. So one of the things that the current standing rule when it comes to anything that is generated by a machine learning tool, an AI tool, is that if it has no human in the loop, which is the litmus test, then it's not copyrightable, right? It's not real. It's not real IP in that regard. It's not intellectual property because it is generated. There's no human in the loop for it. So you can't copyright it. You could totally sell it, but you can't copyright it. The rules are not as clear about the inputs to the system. So the prompts themselves, unless those prompts are also generated by an AI tool, which I'm not discounting the possibility, but let's assume for the moment that the prompts are all human written and just copy pasted the parts that are duplicates. Then if that's the case, then the prompts are actually copyrightable. The output, not so much, but the prompts, assuming that you're human written or at least have a significant amount of human in the loop on the prompt, that is copyrightable. And that being the case, licenses like the Creative Commons license apply. So if you're going to say that something's open source and it's copyrightable, give it a license that reinforces the fact that it's open source, right? Please do that. Another little bit of AI news, which is complicating matters just a little bit, not as much, but to a degree, is Anthropic recently announced that Claude is going to have a watermarking system with text that it generates. And the way that the watermarking system works is it's going to basically tokenize the word. So it'll make a particular pattern of character and word choices that are statistically unlikely for a human to generate. That's going to give the block of text a fingerprint that should be easily identifiable as being AI generated, which means that it's impervious to, if you were to copy it on a piece of, copy the text verbatim from pen to paper or from screen to pen and paper, or copy and paste to a plain text editor or any of those things, the watermark will persist, because it's in the actual choice of words and characters that are being used. Now, if you take that same tool and run it through another large language tool like Grok or ChatGPT or whatever, then there's half a chance that that watermark will get distorted and blocked out. So you could probably get rid of it. But this is a thing that even if you're using these tools for editing, I'm talking about specifically with respect to writing or code, if you're using these things for editing, you're also likely to get watermarked for AI. So the notion of proper provenance of where the origin of the stuff comes from is still problematic. And so the reason why this complicates matters is that it's done for legal purposes, but it may make witch hunting worse, because already AI detectors are giving tons of false positives, and people are no better at AI detecting. And this watermark kind of makes sense, but at the end of the day, probably also circumventable, and the ones that don't circumvent it are going to get bit in the ass. And so that's, again, these are the challenges that we have with the discourse, because things keep moving so quickly and because things keep changing. So that's all right. So we know where my basic lens that I'm working through here, and we know where the challenges are with actually having a rational conversation about these tools. Now, I am going to step in here, and I'm going to talk about, well, this is my podcast, so I get to talk about what interests me and what doesn't interest me. And this is what I think is my personal opinion about what I find is interesting in these conversations, interesting in these discussions, interesting about the technology, and what isn't interesting. And I'm going to start with what isn't interesting, because it's these things that are, and maybe this is my own personality trait, or maybe this is something else, but I oftentimes, what everyone else thinks is interesting, I don't. And let me get into that. First one I want to get into is jobs. The notion that these tools are going to are destroying careers, destroying lives, taking away jobs. I'm not going to say that's not true. I am going to say it's not super interesting. Here's why. And if anybody has lost their job as a result of an AI tool being used to basically replace their functionality, replace their job function, I hear you, and I feel for you, and I know folks who have been through this, and I know when I say that that topic doesn't interest me, it may hurt, may come across as callous, but this is where I want to try and speak with some level of sensitivity. And I'm probably going to fail. I'm going to try not to fail. So please provide me some grace. Like I said, I've been nervous to record this episode for weeks, but every argument about AI and jobs is literally a repackaging of the arguments we saw in the 90s about outsourcing. It's every single one of those arguments. And that's not to say that those arguments didn't hold any weight then. But the hopeful version of this is that we've gotten through that for the most part. There are some things that people still talk about, you know, people stealing jobs and outsourcing and those sort of things. But I'm not going to say it's a solved problem, but it's being addressed. And it's the same context, the same problems we had in that space are going to be the same problems we're going to run into outsourcing to machines. Instead of outsourcing to another country, we're outsourcing to machines. So it's literally the same problem space. And a lot of the solutions to that, however shape you want to make it, are similar. They're the same kind of solutions. But here's the bigger thing. I have seen more than once the sentiment of, I want a robot to wash my dishes and do my laundry so I can do art, not to do the thing that I think is fun. And there's a problem with that. There's two problems with that. One problem is this. The creative class, as a group, we thought we escaped the Industrial Revolution. We thought, look at people in factories and stuff like that being replaced by robots. Haha, we're immune to that because we do creative shit and we're special. So, yay. Turns out, no, we're wrong. It was just off, delayed by 100 years. And we as a class of people are having a very difficult time reconciling that. And again, this is not a beating drum of progress kind of conversation that I'm trying to give. I'm just saying that this, just like with the outsourcing conversation, this is a repackaging. It's the same problem, similar solutions, similar outcomes. And to the laundry and robots conversation, it's a sad fact. What we do as creatives, doesn't matter if we're making music or making animations, making movies, making TV commercials, writing books, doing poetry, what we do, the actual mechanical thing that we do, is boring to everyone else. How many times have you had a conversation and you started trying to talk shop about, if you're doing 3D, about how you're laying the topology on your character and how it's so cool that this is happening that way, or the latest little physics simulations and how that's playing out and really, really cool stuff, or the talking about writing and talking about the structure of how I've got the pacing on my story just right. And nobody cares. Everybody else thinks that shit is boring. We like doing boring things. That's okay. It is. We do. We are. And I don't know of a better way of saying that. But at the end of the day, the vast majority of people, and I'm going to say that people who are in the creative class, the people who do make music, do painting, do animation, do video, do all of these things, those of us that do those things, we're not the majority. Most people don't do those things. Most people don't enjoy doing those things. They are the boring things. Most people don't want to create. They want to have created. And actually, this is even true among the creative class of people. There are many people who are artists, who are designers, who are musicians. They don't want to make it. They want to have made it. They want it to be produced and be done. The enjoyment for process, the people who enjoy the process of producing things, we're an even smaller subclass of the creative class, right? So there's all of the world who thinks making shit is boring and they don't want to do it and they just want to have the output. Then there's the people who actually make shit, who a large chunk of us, maybe, I think, pretty sure, a large chunk of us also think doing the work is boring, but it's worth it because the thing at the end is so cool. And then there's a smaller amount of us that say, you know what? I don't actually care what the end looks like. I just want to make it. I don't care what the end looks like. That's a very rare breed. That's a very, very small segment of the population. And for everybody else who's not in that very, very small segment of the population, what we do is boring as hell and should be automated as far as they're concerned. Because they don't want to do it. They don't want necessarily to pay someone else to do it. They want it done. This is the reality that we live in. This is the reality that you live in. The number of people who want to do is much smaller than the number of people who want results. And how you get the results, how they get the results, ultimately doesn't matter. That is why the conversation about jobs is not interesting to me. Because at the end of the day, what I do, what I enjoy doing, is boring to everybody else, and I have to be okay with that. And if they want to pay me to do this thing that they find boring, sweet. But if they want to pay or get for free someone else or something else to do that boring thing, as far as they're concerned, it's just as dull as doing laundry. And it sucks, but that's why that conversation doesn't super interest me. And here's another one that's going to piss some people off. Theft. There is the big problem that people have with how these large language models, particularly the large language models. Now, I'm not talking about necessarily any of the other training or any of the other neural network AI stuff that everyone else is also claiming is also AI. Right now, I'm just talking about the large language model stuff that's used for generative work. And that is the methodology by which those models are trained. It is couched in the conversation of theft. You're stealing an artist's work in order to crib their style or recreate their style, recreate their aesthetic. There's something to be said about like recreating somebody's look, because your look, you can copyright, you can trademark your own look, right? Style, you can't, but your person, your face, the things that identify you as you. So this is why, you know, you have to get permission and clearances to photograph people in public and, or not in public, but photograph people for commercial use and those sort of things. That's a slightly separate thing, but the premise that theft was done in order to train these models, I'm going to say it's disingenuous. That's the word I'll use. The reason why I say that is there's a few things. One, I will say actual theft has happened. Full disclosure, when Anthropic got caught with their pants down because they pirated a whole bunch of books for training data, two of my books, well, multiple editions of one book, Blender for Dummies, and GIMP Bible, both of those books were in that pirated set. And I think, I haven't seen any money from it, but I think I was on the beneficiary side of that class action lawsuit. The problem with that wasn't that they trained using my book, or anybody's book for that matter. At least according to the courts, and on some level I kind of agree, the problem, the theft, was the fact that they pirated the books to get the material. Had they bought all of those books and then trained their models on it, yeah, you might only get, in my case, I think I got like $1 per sale, so I would have gotten maybe, what, $3? But they would have at least paid for the material, satisfied the license to, and then done the training thing on it. But they didn't. They literally did do piracy, and that's what they got in trouble for. So there have been moments like that, but scraping the public web, that one's a harder sell as theft. It doesn't feel good. I don't like it. It doesn't feel fair necessarily, but that doesn't change the fact that it's probably still not theft. Also, I'm going to just sort of throw this out there. If we're going to laud, if we're going to applaud a book like Steal Like an Artist, which is, I think, the author on that is Austin Kleon. If we're going to applaud a book with that title, and I have read it, but if we're going to applaud a book with that title, kind of puts us in a bad position to find fault with stealing for inspiration, stealing for ideas, stealing for style, stealing for these sorts of things. On some level, I will agree, the people who are building and training these LLMs may have read that book and got the wrong thing out of it. Totally agree with that. But it also, just poor marketing on our end. Just saying. The other part of it is you'll see people say that, well, no, it's a sense of scale, because, you know, an individual person, yeah, as a creator, I draw inspiration from all sorts of media and experiences that I've been involved with and have done those sort of things. But because it's the entire internet, it's the sense of scale, it's somehow different. And I can't find myself rationally agreeing with that. And here's why. That same argument was made against piracy back in the 90s. And we're seeing, again, things are cyclical. These same conversations keep happening over and over. They're just repackaged. And the way this one works was that big studios, the Recording Industry of America, the Motion Picture Association of America, they were basically saying, we lost money. And it's, you know, people would say, what about like mixtapes or whatever? But it's a sense of scale, right? It's because it's so easily done and because it's so large that suddenly makes it worse. And that argument was bullshit then. Just putting that out there. The sense, because it's bigger, is a bullshit argument. That doesn't hold any water with me. That doesn't make any sense. And it doesn't, and I'm not going to go into why it didn't make sense then, but it also doesn't make sense now. From a just from a purely consistency standpoint, from a pure sense of consistency, the notion that because it's bigger makes it worse or more severe, it doesn't play out. It's not that same. If it works in one case, it's not consistent. It doesn't play out. It doesn't work. So the sense of scale argument is it doesn't apply. Long story short, I feel the pain of the theft argument. I understand how much it sucks. I see how it doesn't feel fair and it doesn't feel right, but I don't think the argument holds a whole lot of water. And again, it's still, the jury's still out court-wise in terms of cases and legal stuff. And the fact of the matter is that the courts and the laws are going to lag behind this in a way that by the time they decide anything, it's probably going to be too late. And here's the thing that probably sucks even more. You didn't lose any money. Those people were never going to pay you. This is the same conversation again that happened with piracy. Your work wasn't stolen. Outside of it being actually pirated, right? Outside of that sort of thing. For the vast majority of the work that was used to train these models, I don't buy the theft argument. I don't like the way that these things, I don't like how they were trained. I would prefer them to have paid for a license to do that kind of training. But one, the licenses, the permissions for that didn't even exist when they were doing it. And for another, it's one of those things where, similar to a previous episode, I can talk about how I would rather the world be versus talking about how the world is. And this is one of those shitty situations where we're in a place where the world is. This stuff is the basis for a lot of training, and it's about, where do we go from here? Because I'm not convinced we're going to be able to put the genie back in the bottle here. And that's, as much as it sucks, that's where I think reality sits. We don't have to accept it, and there's a lot of things we can do about it, but that's where we are, right? Now, on the other side of this conversation, the super pro AI side of things, this is the future, this is the way things are going to be. Let me just start by saying this right now. Anybody who says they know what the future of producing things looks like, you're wrong. Nobody, I mean, you could be right on accident. Nobody knows where this is going. No one knows where this is headed. Most people can't keep up with it. Even the people who are involved with the technology itself have no idea where it's going. This is where you end up having meetings with people who are saying, you're going to be using this new AI technology. Now explain to me how you're going to be using it and making it valuable to us, to our organization or whatever, right? There is a large part of this, it's a solution looking for a problem. And there's a lot of problems that you could apply this thing to, but it is still very much a solution looking for a problem. So this whole conversation about democratizing creativity, just stop, right? You're not democratizing creativity. People are inherently creative. Tons of people are creative. Everyone. I mean, when I was running an animation studio, anybody who has said that they make anything, how many times have you been approached with somebody who's an ideas person? Oh, I have this wonderful idea. You should make it for me, right? That hasn't changed. It's not going to change. In fact, on some level, I could be grateful that AI tools exist because now these people won't come to me saying that they have an idea that I should make rather than, and then, and not be paid for to make that, make their idea instead of my own. So on some level, I'm kind of grateful that there's this vent called AI tools that they can, these people can go and have a robot try to build whatever they have in their head, and they don't necessarily have to bother me with it. That said, anybody who has good ideas, let me know. We'll see what we can do. I'm being a little glib, but at the end of the day, look, creativity has not been democratized. People are creative. The cost of production has been lowered. Depends on where you're, you know, putting the cost of it. Right now, it's lowered until people start charging more for using these LLM models. But the production cost will be lowered. Distribution may also be easier. But creativity itself has been where it's always been. Ideas are cheap. With AI, they're cheaper. It's just the way that rolls out. You're not democratizing anything. You're making it faster for folks to make really sexy bad ideas. If that, and maybe that's necessary. Like I said, there's a certain part of me that's thankful because somebody who has an unrealistic expectation about what it takes to produce anything, they have a place where they can go and, worst case, produce their whatever they want and not bother anybody else with it. Best case, do the previs work and say, I want something like this, but I want someone to actually, now this is a better explanation, a better pre-visualization, a better prototype of what I'm trying to do. And now I'm going to put it in the hands of somebody who actually has skills to make it in reality. That's workable, right? It's one of those things where they do the groundwork with one of these models. They do concept or ideas, which, again, these are also jobs people do, but sometimes it's about taking a bad idea and letting it die on the vine early. Now we're not bothered by it. But for the ideas that can sort of, that have merit, that have had some time to germinate and work with that, now there's something that's an easier starting point. And I don't even mean that as with actual assets or media, but at least it's like, oh, you want this, but in a way that doesn't suck. Let's see how we can do it. Assuming that the fundamentals all make sense, right? You can't spit shine a shitty story, right? That's not going to make the story any better, right? But if the story basis is solid, but the final production, the final edits, the specific word choice for a written story, the specific visuals or scene selection for a visual story, those things put in the hands of somebody who knows what they're doing could be beneficial. Again, it's not democratizing anything. It's at best previs, and at worst, it's getting, basically, at worst, it's getting people not to bother people who are doing this type of work with stuff that either is uninteresting or doesn't have any grounds, or they're not going to get paid for anyway. And then that's why I don't think that the democratizing creativity thing held. It's not interesting to me. It's, again, I don't think it holds a lot of merit, and it's kind of boring. It doesn't interest me. The last one is and it's sort of related. It's the notion of AI slop, right? That's been like the pejorative word that people are just throwing out now everywhere they can. It's like, oh, it's slop, it's slop, it's AI slop, AI slop this, AI slop that. I'm not interested in that. This goes back also to the witch hunts. It's just not interesting to me. There has always been a slush pile. And the difference is, I will say to the democratizing thing, the difference is that there are fewer gatekeepers now. And this has nothing necessarily to do with AI. A little bit, but by and large, the reduction in gatekeepers has been a continuing and ongoing trend. So that I'm not attributing to AI. It's just more of that. Slush pile is real. It's always been around. It's always been a thing. And now we all get to see it. Woo! And on the one hand, when everybody sees the slush pile, when everybody sees this mean average, because there is some merit to the statement that unless you put some really heavy work into it, which at the same, on some level, is you may as well have just made it by hand. Unless you put that level of work into it, you're hitting an average, right? You're hitting an average in terms of quality and substance that of all these works put together, the good and the bad all sort of averaged out. And even then, it's even if it's slightly above average, it's still sameness, right? This means that excellent work is still going to rise to the top. Great work is still going to rise to the top. Now, the counter to that is like, well, what if I don't do great work? What if I am average? What if I am exactly at that average place? There is a smidgen of hope there in that if you are a person who is who produces generally average work, but you have the strong fundamentals, you have a strong background, you have all the, you have taste, then arguably if you use something like this as a starting point from the average, assuming you decide you want to use it, because again, you don't have to, but if you did, then you are a leap ahead above somebody who doesn't have fundamentals, who doesn't have taste, who doesn't have accruing of skills and experiences necessary to do what you do. So if there's a fun argument in somebody goes to a freelancer and says, well, why would I pay you to do that? I can do it with AI. And the freelancer can say, okay, well, look, you do it with AI and I'll do it with AI and we'll see who is better. There's something to be said for fundamental training, fundamental skills and taste, and knowing what to ask for, knowing the language to work within, right? There is institutional knowledge. There is baked in understanding from the practice of doing this work that somebody who is, I'll say, more of a pedestrian level is not going to have. So there is an advantage to that. And at the end of the day, this is all our fault anyway. Not our fault as creatives, but it's our fault as people. We, at some point, decided that good enough was good enough. I personally put a lot of blame on YouTube culture, probably unfairly, and ironically, considering the fact that I'm also running this podcast on YouTube and my production quality is eh. But the notion that we, from a production quality level, from that perspective, we have trained ourselves as a society to accept good enough, right? If you understand the Pareto rule, if you understand 80-20, 80% of the work is done in the last 20% before completion, right? And there's a lot of different variations on that, but that's the one that I stick with in my head, is that if you want to get something to really be polished, most of your time is going to be spent in the last 20% of getting that extra stuff that nobody else does. That last 20% is what makes things special now. That 20% is what separates you from the machines, because the machines can do 80%. And the problem is most people is good enough. They'll accept slop, one, because they don't know any different. And really, most people, I said this before, most people can't tell. And if they say they can tell, they probably can't, and it's not going to last. Because 80% is going, even if you can tell, 80% is going to be good enough for most folks who don't want to put any more extra energy into that part of their thing. Because this goes back to the witch hunt thing. Because I mean, this is not necessarily the slop part of it, but it is related to it. The whole concept, this whole bullshit notion of, well, if you used AI here, then you totally, how did I know you didn't use it over here? And therefore, your whole thing is, you've lost integrity with the whole thing. Really? We're gonna go with that. I mean, yes, there is something to be said about the integrity of a person. And if they say, if somebody is pristine, I have never ever used and I'm never going to use, and that's the whole thing, then they can maybe keep that argument. But not, there aren't, the population, even unwittingly at this point, is going to be using tools that they can be claimed as being AI or be mistaken for being AI or being these sorts of things. So, and on top of that, if you're using, the example I see this all the time in is with books, right? It's one of the ecosystems that I spend a lot of time in because, well, I write. And for people who are writers, they're typically not marketers. They're typically not book cover designers. They're typically not illustrators. They're typically not any of these things. And they're a person probably in a room, not unlike this one, maybe smaller, who can't afford a cover designer, can't afford to have a full in-person edit on their manuscript done, can't afford to have all of these things done. So they use the tools that they have at their disposal, the tools they have hand. They were never going to pay an artist to get a cover out, and therefore their work was never going to get published without these tools. And that is not a thing on the democratization part of it. That's just economics. And so nobody's losing money with this. They're not, you can't tell somebody like this, well, you should have paid somebody to do it. Their choices are use a tool that does it or don't have it and don't put it out in the world. And if they believe enough about their story, and again, I'm talking specifically about writing in this case, but it works for all sorts of places. If they believe enough in their story to think that there's an audience for it, then they need to find a way to get it out there. And book covers can be changed over time. Just because they are not a multifaceted creative polymath that's able to do writing and music composition and video production and cover design and illustration for the cover and photography for the base reference image and the editing for their story. They're not likely to be all of these things at the same time. I do a lot of them, but I also know that I'm weird. And I also like doing a lot of them. Most people, they don't like doing all of those things, and they're not necessarily highly skilled at doing those things. So they do with what, and they don't have the money to pay someone else who is. So they get 80% of the way there. They generate some kind of slop that gets the idea across. I mean, you've got situations now where people are showing off a cover design concept that they're saying, this is the concept that I've put together for my book cover that I would like to get an actual illustrator and designer to work on, but I want to give this illustrator and designer enough room to work within to say, this is what I'm looking for, make it better than this, make it correct. Do it all from scratch, but do it. This is the composition that I'm looking for. They're getting shit for posting that to try to get feedback because I used AI to do the concept part of it. How many different processes in this step are you going to try to have money soaked out of these people? It's unrealistic. So I understand that all the work has a sameness. I understand that the work is not the best out there. It doesn't have to be for a lot of these people. Again, they want it to have been made. They don't want to be making it. And they can't afford it to have been made by somebody else. So you're going to tell somebody that they can't bring something that they've worked on in a different medium to life, because the medium that they're not an expert in, they didn't get it produced by hand by an expert because they couldn't afford that, or because they didn't have the skill to do it themselves. It's a bullshit point of view. And to assume the worst in people, maybe that's the problem I have, is that the notion of, well, you used AI for your book cover, so I can't believe that you didn't use AI for anything else, assumes people are horrible, shitty people. And walking into a room, virtually or otherwise, walking into a room with that assumption is so toxically negative. Why would you inflict that upon yourself? Why? Let them do their thing. And then if their story has merit, if their story is good, give it room to breathe. If it's successful, hell, they will have enough money to afford a better cover, and they'll do it. I've seen it happen. So I digressed a little bit onto the witch hunt thing from the concept of slop, but that's, I'm passionate about it, but I don't want to talk about it. I'm not interested in it. So this is hopefully the last time I have to have that part of that conversation, because I think the whole mindset is shitty and I don't want to think negatively of other people. So I'm going to choose to see if I see something that this part's not that great. One, I'm going to say, first of all, that's not that great. I'm not going to assume because it's not that great, it's AI, or because it is really great, it's AI, or whatever tell anybody wants to say. I'm not going to make that assumption. I'm going to judge it based on what it is, and I'm going to assume the person has good intention, because, again, it feels shitty to think otherwise, and I don't want to think about fellow people that way, and I don't think you should either, but I can't control you. I can't tell you what to do. It's just what I'm doing. Now that I've gotten that out of the way, I can talk about the things that are actually interesting, things that are topics that are worth talking about, because those other ones I spend a lot of time on. And I think ironically, the stuff that I find most interesting, ironically and probably painfully, the stuff that I find most interesting will be the shortest part of this episode, which is annoying. I mean, hopefully maybe you guys find those other interesting things as interesting as I do, and we can do other episodes on that. But I really don't want to spend too many episodes on AI, because there's plenty of content about this, and I don't want to do it. I'd rather talk about open source and cool stuff and those sort of things. So now, let's talk about the things that are interesting and worthy, in my opinion, worth having conversations about. And the number one thing on my mind, for sure, is the environmental impact of these tools. This is a serious concern. It's not necessarily a blemish on the technology overall, though. When I say the technology, I mean large language models, AI, these kinds of things. Because if you're using Blender and using denoising, you're using AI technology. If you're, again, I gave a list earlier on, there's a lot of different places where AI technology is being used, and it's locally hosted. It's working on your machine. It is not going out to a cloud, which I already have problem. Half the reason why I don't use these tools is because I don't trust other people's computers, which is what the cloud is, which is where data centers are, which is where all this stuff happens. If I can host it local, then I'm more interested in it. And that's one of the antidotes, I think, to the conversation about the environmental impact of these tools, is you don't necessarily need giant data centers for them. And yes, the frontier models are doing it. Yes, they're using large amounts of power. Here's a thought, and I'm going to extend this. So if we think about these tools in the context of outsourcing, like I was talking about at the beginning of it, beginning of this episode, then imagine everybody can outsource to a worker in another country. Right? Those people have to eat. They have to sleep. They have toilet matters they have to take care of. They've got waste, is what I'm talking about. They've got all of these different things. They consume power. Now imagine if every single person outsourced. That's the level of that you, I would assume, I haven't done the math, but the level of energy usage probably is comparable to what you're seeing with the usage from these tools and data centers and those sort of things. And at the end of the day, data centers were in a lot of ways, they were their own solution looking for a problem, right? Data centers worked and they're great, but a large chunk of them, their compute power at least, sat idle. I mean, this is the same situation you ran into with crypto, right? You got these giant banks of computers not doing a whole bunch. Well, let's figure out something to do with them. So, you know, you have crypto mining, you have these sort of things. Well, then what's another thing? Well, we can train and process these large language models on these giant data centers that originally were kind of sitting idle. Now they're not sitting idle, and now there's not enough processing power to service all of the needs that everybody's asking for. So they want to expand. The problem is that these things are engineered, the way that these things are built, when I say these things, I mean the technology, the AI technology, it's literal brute force, right? It is taking a sledgehammer to a bank vault, trying to get the goods out of it. And that's the way that all sort of new technology kind of does their thing, is you prove that the solution exists, and then you refine the solution. So the thing is that, one, I think the environmental impact is real. I don't think. I know the environmental impact is real, and it's something that needs to be addressed, but I don't think that necessarily invalidates the technology overall. It means that pressure needs to be placed in the right topics, right zones. And what I mean by that is your boycott of AI tools or AI technology is not going to affect anything. You being loud about boycotting it also not likely to affect anything. It's not going to stop a data center from being built, because that's handled at those data centers have to be built on land. That land has to be purchased and zoned correctly. So this becomes a governmental conversation, right? This becomes a regulatory conversation. That's where the pressure needs to be applied more for that. More importantly, the way you handle that is infrastructure costs, water, cooling, energy, these sorts of things need to be high enough that they incentivize making this shit work more efficiently. Because then you don't need more data centers. You can use what you have more efficiently. That is a more interesting next phase for at least the cloud level variation of this technology, the outsource variation, the SaaS variation, software as a service variation of this technology, is not treating everything, not being the giant hammer beating on the bank vault door. Instead, figure out how to get they're working on their right now. The idea of efficiency is, okay, how do we use a jack? How we change our hammer into a jackhammer? Anybody who's paying attention, that just means that's more brute force. What would be more interesting is lockpicks. What's a different way of getting into the vault? What's a different way of doing it more efficiently that doesn't cause as much noise, batter up the door, and cause as much problems? We should be incentivizing making things cost enough that the people who are using this technology and building the hardware for it are incentivized to look into those approaches, look into the approaches that are more energy efficient and do it better. Because you're not, I could very easily be wrong with this, but you're not getting, the technology is not likely to go away. It'll transform, it'll go sort of on the back end, it'll be dormant, it'll be something that people will ultimately, I guess, people will sort of thoughtlessly use it because there'll be something else that we'll be all concerned and worried about. This has happened with a number of technologies over the years that people have been worried and concerned about. But the emphasis isn't going to be on trying to shame everybody who uses it and boycotting it yourself. That's not going to solve the problem. That's not going to affect things at the environmental level that we're talking about. It's really going to be about, from my perspective, you trying to, one, thinking about your own sovereignty, your own digital sovereignty, and self-hosting and self-training and doing local as much as you can, because your computer is going to be your computer and it's going to be locked that way. That's step one. And step two is making these data centers expensive enough that it's in the vendor's best interest to do things more efficiently. Because if they're doing things more efficiently, then you can work, sort of think about these data centers as their means, as their currency. You work within your means and you can get the better results. This is, computing ran into this, right? So there's a reason why we have power efficient CPUs. There's a reason why ARM exists at all, is because it's more power efficient and still really powerful. These sort of things, these problems have been addressed. These problems are things people have dealt with, and they can continue to deal with them. And I think this is how it's done. That's the approach, I think. Like, I don't think you're going to get it's going to be effective to say this has a nasty effect on the environment, so you can't do it. I don't think you can take it away from people at this point. I could be wrong. I don't mind being wrong. I just don't think I am. I think it's more effective. You're already seeing half the data centers that were slated at the beginning of this year to be built are being delayed by a number of years. So, and the ones that are going to be built, they're not going to be done for 3 years, and they're going to have obsolete hardware. So they're going to have to be more efficient anyway, because they're going to have old shit to work with. I'm being a bit optimistic here. That, I believe, is going to level out, and I'm hopeful that it does, because what's going on right now, totally not sustainable. But I think we're exerting pressure in the wrong places to fix that. What else is interesting? Well, I already sort of got into the whole notion of small language models, SLM, not LLM, SLM. These are the this is the segment of machine learning and artificial intelligence that I'm actually much more interested in, because these things, for anybody who doesn't know, again, the whole concept of using AI as a broad term is problematic. One of the things that fits in there is the notion of these small language models that you can self-host, stuff that you can run locally on your own computers and solve very small, very specific problems in a very efficient way that is more predictable and trainable and less jank in terms of output, right? So things like, if you're talking about VFX, for instance, and you want to do garbage mats. And so, all right, well, I have a character sitting in front and doing a thing in front of a camera, and I need to put a new background on them, and I want to do a garbage mat and paint. Also, I'll paint out frame one, and I was like, I have 1,000 frames to do it. So I manually paint out frame one, maybe frame 500, and maybe frame 1,000, just to show the bits and pieces and say, cool, these are the parts that I need painted out. Use a small language model tool to generate the garbage mats for all the interim frames. This technology exists. This technology is interesting. It is repeatable, is automatable, and it helps you on the ground already with that one very specific task you're trying to get done. There are tons of these little opportunities all over the place, and they don't take a lot of power, and they solve very specific problems, and they're very useful. And you can do stuff a little bit larger, right? You can do text-to-speech on your own computer. You can do digital voice cloning with open source tools right now. And I can share some of those at some point. There's a few of them out there that are they do pretty impressive work. You don't have to go to 11 labs and do all the stuff that they're doing in there, which, I mean, they produce decent quality output, but you could also not be beholden to that, follow an open source methodology, be able to self-host, use the small language model concept, and run it locally with some with the these open source models, open source tools that are doing that. So that's one of the things I find way more interesting. And there's actually a lot more possibilities for useful, functional tools that help you right now get things done in a very predictable way that you don't have to like basically play, you know, AI slots trying to figure out, you know, pull the lever. Nope, that's not the right one. Pull the lever again. Nope, that's not the right one, because it's changing so many different variables at the same time. When you're working at the small language model scale, your problem space is smaller. The solutions are easier and faster and less power hungry. And that's, for me, that's probably one of the more, and again, I'm not using much of these right now. I'm looking at them. I'm considering them for ideas on things, but I'm not currently using them. But if I were, that's the stuff I'd be looking at first. Anything self-hosted, anything that I can run on my own computer that, again, is not going to have the environmental impact of trying to run something through a data center, even if it runs slower. Hell, I've been doing 3D animation for years. If I'm, you know, if I'm already used to spending hours on renders, what's the difference in spending hours waiting for a very specific result from a locally hosted machine learning algorithm happening? I think my computer can handle it, and I'm used to doing that. Wait, no, it's not going to be instantaneous, but I'm an animator. I'm used to waiting on shit. So this is a space that I find, if I was going to use the word exciting, and I hesitate to do it because it takes a lot to get me excited, but if I were, that's the space, the self-hosted small language models, small neural network solutions to very specific problems. Those like in-betweening, or there's a whole list of things that are infinitely more interesting and infinitely more useful from my perspective than trying to solve all the world problems with the same basic large language algorithm. So I would love to talk more about that, especially with people who are working in that space. So if you happen to be one of those people, come hit me up. We'll talk more. Maybe we'll get you on the show. There are some things that are, I'll say, scary. And they are, on that regard, interesting to talk about. One of them, and this is the one that a lot of people talk about, and that is the prospect of digital cloning. The idea that somebody could take the episodes of this podcast, and even with open source tools right now, actually even with open source tools, they don't have to go on a cloud hosted anything. They could do this all locally. I could do this locally. You could take this, all the episodes I have in my podcast. You could probably get away with just one episode. Take my voice, take my goofy face saying shit, and get me to say anything. Get me to look like I'm doing anything. This is a concern. This is something that's interesting. This is something worth worrying about. Not just on the level of like, well, someone's going to make me look bad on the internet. I do a fine job of my own looking bad on the internet. I don't need your help for it. But the notion of people who have no scruples using this technology for scams, trying to set up a thing where they call my mother using my voice to get her to buy something from them and scam a lot of money out of her account. For the record, she's broke. So good luck trying to do that. In any case, so don't try that. That well is dry, but sorry, Mom. but I'm not, I mean, that's my selfish view, but that's a view for other people as well. The notion that anybody, and you don't have to be somebody with a platform like this, right? You can be done with somebody being recorded off the street, or a few lines recorded on a phone call or a Zoom conversation, or that is enough data to train a believable clone, facsimile, of any person. and make them say and do things. So the question of what, how do you verify authenticity in that environment? How do I prove that this is me talking to you and that you are there listening to me? Right. That is a non-trivial, very interesting problem that people talk about, people have concern about, but we don't have solutions to this. This is a space that, let's make the assumption right now, this technology isn't going away. I'm not going to say it's the future. It's in the future, right? It's here now, and it's clearly going to be in the future. And I mean, things can get taken away. I'm going to back up a second and say things can get taken and regulated away. I mean, there are drugs on the market now that were in Coca-Cola, right? That are illegal and hardcore drugs now. They're not on the market, right? There is a universe where AI tools get treated that kind of way, and there's a pullback. But the substance still exists. The technology will still exist. It's still going to be there. So this is also the time to look at this and say, okay, how do we verify individual authenticity in the digital space? Outside, because in meat space, we're pretty sure that when I talk to you in person, you're you. I mean, there are some people where I think they may be robots. They might be robots, but those people notwithstanding, I will say, by and large, if I'm seeing you in person, for the time being, I can assume that you're actually who I'm talking to and that there's some level of authenticity to that interaction. But in the digital space, how do we manage that? How do I ensure that the people that I care about aren't lied to by a fake me? This is an interesting problem. This is something that I'm interested in seeing what solutions exist to address it. This is something I think we should be talking more about. And I would be much happier talking about that topic and much more interested in all of our conversations, every single conversation about AI slop and theft of art and they're stealing our jobs. If every one of those conversations was focused on what the hell are we going to do about digital clones being used to scam the people we love? That's a conversation I want to be a part of. That's a conversation I want to hear a solution to. That's where I would like to see our energy placed. This, everything, those other things, yeah, that's where it's the low-hanging fruit, but it's not the interesting stuff. It's not the thing that we should really be concerned about. Here's another one that other people don't talk about that I've been saying to people I know for a number of years now. This is, like I said, this is a topic that's been long coming. Before I restarted the podcast, this was going to be a whole blog post, but I have a podcast now, so I'm going to use this for that. Here's the thing. In a world where there is a proliferation of machine learning and AI tools, the thing that is going to separate one work from another work is your humanity, is your inherent you-ness. Cloning notwithstanding. Even with a clone, the clone's a clone, there's believability and then there's really you, right? So the thing that is you, the fact that you are a person, that you make mistakes, that you try things, that you have experiments, that you have your own flaws, that you have things that you're really fucking good at. Those things, that you have opinions, those things are what ultimately are going to set you apart, set your work apart from machine-generated work, right? Machine-generated work is still work. It's going to have a certain quality level. Hell, it might be better than yours one day. What's going to differentiate that machine work from your work is you. Upside, you're pretty good at being you. No one else can be you. So you're the expert there. Great. Downside, you have to be you. This means that the era of being anonymous famous, about the reclusive anonymous creative, is gone. The world belongs to extroverts. In this world where AI tools proliferate, if your differentiator is your humanity, then you have to be able to express that humanity to others, which means you either have to be an extrovert or you have to act like one. I am not one. I'm trying to put on a show. And that's basically how that is something on a philosophical and a psychological level that I don't think people are talking about enough. The notion that, you know, it's easy to say, okay, well, being a person is what's your differentiator, right? That's your innate value proposition, if we're going to get all businessy about it, right? That's what separates you and your work from anybody else's, whether they're other humans or they're machines. The thing that separates your work is the fact that you did it. Great. And so you have to be able to express that humanity. You have to be able to let everybody know, hey, I'm a person and I did a thing. That's the behavior of an extrovert. That is the behavior of somebody who is willing to go out. It's the behavior of an extrovert, but you don't have to be one, but you have to act like one. And I think that is lamentable. That is, that's a tough pill to swallow, particularly because so many of us in the creative space are not social, are not sociable, are not in front of the camera type of people. We're backstage people. We're radio voices. We're the people behind the words, right? We're not a face. We're not an actual voice. We're not used to that. We're not comfortable with that. We don't want to be that. Now we have to be. And it sucks. And that's interesting to talk about. That's how do we address that? Is there a solution for that that doesn't involve us putting on a clown suit and acting like a goofball? Is there a solution that doesn't involve exhausting moments of trying to interact with people? Because I love going on live events. I love talking to people. It is something that is I truly enjoy doing. That's why I go to SIGGRAPH. That's why I go to BCON. But it exhausts the hell out of me. And I've come to terms with that. I came to terms with that a long time ago, is that I just have to make sure that I have enough fuel in the tank, water in the well, whatever metaphor you want to use. I have enough juice to be present and be available at these events and do these things and express my humanity to other people. I've come to terms with that. So for me, I figured out that part for me. I can put on a show. Not everybody's going to be able to do that. And how do we help the people who most need to be able to express their humanity, to get their great work out there, to get the exposure they need to show that this, my work exists and my differentiator is that I'm human and that I'm not, and that's one of the things that makes me worth reading, watching, consuming versus this piece of machine output of some sort. How do we help them express that humanity without exhausting them, without requiring the dog and pony show that it seems like we're all going to have to put on? This is an interesting problem. This is a challenge that I would like to see us try to address. I don't know how. I don't know. I mean, my solution was to act like an extrovert when I have to. It's not necessarily a healthy way of doing it. It might be, but it's the solution that I have. It'd be nice if there's a better one. This is a conversation worth having. In the realm of AI tools and these are the problems that are interesting to me, that I want to talk more about, that I want to hear more about. I want to hear solutions to this. I want to hear people addressing this problem and recognizing that it even exists, because I don't think anybody else has mentioned it to me. I've been mentioning it to other people because that's what I talk a lot, but I haven't read this being talked about anywhere. If you see it, please do point it out to me because this is interesting to me. It's probably one of the most interesting parts of that, of the conversation, because the other ones that are interesting are mildly interesting. Like if the job, so we're talking about jobs being pulled back, and most of the jobs that are being pulled back are not necessarily senior positions. It's happening, but what's happening more frequently is the AI tools can get you 80%, right? So they can get you what a junior artist, a junior developer, a junior skilled person is going to can get you. So you just don't hire junior skilled people and you only have seniors. Sweet. Here's the problem. How do you get more seniors if you don't have juniors? Yeah. Interesting problem to try to solve. Now, I think this is actually with a proper educational regimen, with a proper, this can be handled at the education, at the educational academic training level, apprenticeship. There's a lot of different ways to skin that cat and make it, make that, to solve that problem. I think it's a solvable problem. And this is an interesting one worth talking about, is how do you navigate this space? If the problem is that we aren't hiring juniors anymore and therefore can't graduate them to seniors before the seniors retire, step away, die off, whatever, we need to figure out the solutions for that. That's an interesting problem worth talking about. It's I don't think it's as interesting to me as the introvert thing, because that's a little bit closer to home, but it's, from my perspective, a far sight more interesting to talk about than trying to debate the theft of art thing. You know, I have another rant, and as I'm digressing again, and I have to apologize. I had notes on here. I got my notes, and I'm trying to stay on track, but my brain goes on a bunch of different things. And so this is a debate. This is the last time I want to talk about this particular debate, going back to the not interesting things, the notion of whether or not AI art is art. We as a community of creatives have been unable to define what art actually is for the entirety of time. We haven't. We don't know what art is. I know it when I see it, is the thing, right? That's been like that's the best we've got. So for anybody to like draw a line in the sand and say, well, this is and this isn't, you're welcome to the debate. We've been here for years. You're not saying anything new. That's why that conversation isn't interesting to me. The AI art isn't art. I could say a ton of things aren't art, and I'd be just as right as anyone else who says AI art isn't art, or that Jackson Pollock's work isn't art, or that because part of it was painted with apprentices, that Michelangelo's paintings weren't art. You can have this argument all day long, and it's a bullshit argument, and it's not interesting. So I'm not having it. Little rant. Sorry about that. I'm digressing. There is one other thing that is interesting, I think merits conversation, that some folks have talked about, and that is, what other kind of new media can be born from this, right? There is the possibility that this technology, because it's good enough, could circumvent us, people who create things, altogether. What I mean by that is, you could sit down at your phone and say, I want to see a story. I want to see a video of a dude in a turkey suit jumping out of a tree and exploding when he lands, Michael Bay style. And it'll generate it. You get your kicks, you get your giggle, and then you'll move on. It's not an expressive medium. Nobody's, you're feeding yourself. In some level, it's just self-feeding, but there's a nugget of fulfillment there that I don't know if it qualifies as media. And so there is a philosophical question there about if somebody sits down at whatever device they have and says, I want to live through an experience like a video game that is generated on the fly, and environments are created as I move through it, and characters are created as I talk to them, and there's some cohesion from one to the other, and it's sort of just going on kind of dream style. That's a medium. I don't know what function that provides, but it's a product. It's a thing that could exist in the world. What does that do? What does that do for us on a psychological level? What does that do to us as a culture of storytellers? Will it make people better storytellers on their own? I don't know. Or is it just going to be pure masturbation of your own ideas? Also a possibility. I don't know. But this is also something that I find more interesting to talk about when talking about these tools. Now, where I'm running really long, and maybe I'll have to cut some of this down editing wise. I don't think I want to make multiple episodes of this because I'd rather not. I'd rather get this piece out, get it said, make a bunch of little sound bites and stuff like that, but not go too hard into it. But ultimately, the question comes to where does this leave us? Where I've talked about the things that I find interesting and the parts of the debate that I don't find interesting at all. And quite frankly, the things most people are talking about are not the things that I find interesting at all. So I'm not going to engage in very many of those conversations. Just not. But the technology exists. And unless there is a gigantic shift, which I don't foresee happening, the number of people who are outside of the creative producer space who have found value in these tools dwarfs us by multiple orders of magnitude. And I don't think that, you know, we are not the Spartan army that's going to take on this behemoth and win. I don't think that necessarily, and when I say win, I mean these AI tools are not likely to disappear. They'll be refactored. They'll be made more efficient. They'll be set up as background processes. They'll become largely transparent to a lot of day-to-day life. And you and I will unwittingly use a lot of them without even ever knowing it. And that is not how I necessarily want it to be, but that is how I expect it to be. And so most of my mindset, most of my approach to this is, how do I operate in a world where that's the reality? And how do I do so maintaining a level of optimism and hope and my own personal integrity? And I think a lot of it, actually, I personally am benefited by choosing to use open source tools as the fundamental part of my creative toolbox. That's been, I think, is one of the things that, I'm not going to say it gives me a level of immunity, because I already talked about how it didn't last with the Industrial Revolution, and I don't necessarily think it's going to persist necessarily for anything else. But I do think that choosing open source, choosing to self-host, choosing to do things locally on my own hardware gives me a level of sovereignty and independence that I wouldn't otherwise have. And I'm less likely to be dependent and vendor locked in on these large cloud-based infrastructures or large AI as a service, for lack of a better way of saying it, infrastructure. And as far as creative output goes, I mean, to be frank, part of the reason this is why I'm running this podcast again. I need to express my humanity. I need to show people that I'm a living, breathing human being that makes stuff and does hopefully what other people think is cool things. That's, if I'm going to sell cool things, if I'm going to make cool things for an audience, which this is going to be another podcast at some point, the whole notion of unless you're creating for an audience, you're probably not an artist. That'll be a teaser for an episode that I do sometime down the road. But if you are an artist, you are communicating, you have an audience, you are doing something to convey an emotion, a thought, an idea to somebody else who isn't you. That's the essence of it. And if I want to continue doing that, if I want to continue doing the boring shit that I do because it amuses me and because I think other people see value in it, then I need to express my humanity. I need to do those things. And I'm going to leave you with this one little bit because it does help paint a picture of hope. This is not mine. I'm totally cribbing this from Wes Burke, who's one of the co-founders of Autotroph. He said this at BCon in one variation. I've heard him say it in other variations as well, but candle making is a $1 billion industry. We have light bulbs. We have an enormous number of ways to generate heat and light that don't involve burning strings stuck in wax. But there's a $1 billion industry around candle making. And these candles, this goes for everything from the small little votive candles that are used for emergencies to these ornate carved hand scented things that are out there. There's a whole thing, and part of that comes from the craftsmanship, comes from people understanding the human component that's added to a lot of these things. Now, some of that also still is industrialized, right? No getting around that. There's still a level of industrialization because I use the word industry, but that doesn't negate that there is a human element there, that there is creativity there, that there is a way for the boring stuff that other people might think is, that on the face of things may seem vestigial, archaic, useless. There's still a space for those things. If there's anything that I've seen is that nothing ever goes away. Maybe it gets smaller, maybe it gets transformed, maybe it gets modified, but nothing truly ever disappears. And I think that's the nugget of hope worth holding on to. And thinking about all these other bits and pieces that I find are interesting related to that are the things that are most interesting to me. And I think that's a way to move forward. So I would like, as moving forward, I would like to have these conversations about interesting things with you in person, via email, in comments, any of those things. If you want to have a reasoned, rational conversation that addresses where we are rather than where we wish things were, and how do we navigate the space in that reality while maintaining hope, optimism, and integrity, that's what I want to talk about. That's what I'm interested in doing more about. And that's what I think we get by choosing to use open source. I think that there is a lot of benefit from open source tools, open source large language models, open weights for the training on these models. I think all of those things are worth talking about and are viable components of a reality that we can be comfortable living in. And that's what I want to talk about. So with that, that's the end of this episode. Hopefully you stayed through it. I went a lot longer on this one than I've done on many other ones. And I don't know how much I'm going to cut out because I guess I said at the beginning of this thing, I'm pretty nervous about sharing this out with the world and getting any level of hate. Now, then again, maybe nobody sees this podcast and then that's the other thing I have to worry about. But if you found any of these bits and pieces poignant, if you found anything in here insightful, or you disagree with it and you want to address it, share it with other people, share it with me, have conversations with me. I'm a human. I like having conversations. Let's talk about it. I'm interested. In the meantime, it's time to get to work. See you next time.
This is the last job.